Hello, Dialogue Conspiracy again. Monday rolls around again. I hope that all of you have sent wires or letters to the Senator Sam Ervin, the committee in Washington, to keep the Watergate hearings public. There's a lot of pressure at this point to take them off the air, and I think that's because they're revealing so much about the way the system works. It's terribly important in a democracy to watch how the various operatives are manipulating the system and the agencies. These operatives are appointed by the president. They're not elected officials. And he appoints these particular people, and then they leave the White House and work for the committee to reelect the president, and they are sabotaging the electoral system. And to hear them speak about destruction of evidence or forging documents or photographing letterheads reveals a lot about how you get a president elected in the United States. Send a wire to Senator Sam Ervin, Senate Subcommittee on Presidential Campaign Activities, Room G308, if you have a pencil, otherwise, New Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C., 20510. If the hearings go back on the air tomorrow, send him a letter and tell him you appreciate his holding out and having the hearings go back on the air. If they're not on the air, send a note of your displeasure. I think it's a rare opportunity to watch these witnesses on the stand and see how much they're getting away with, to see how much the committee itself is not asking them. It's a disgrace. These men act like they're stupid. I can't believe they're that stupid. And besides that, a lot of information comes out from the mouths of the witnesses, some that they don't mean to come out, and some is intentional. I'm going into some of the things they brought up last week that were important in terms of the news. Before I do that, I came across an article in my cross-filing system that it was from the Monterey High School last June. It was 2 years ago this week. This is an anniversary at KLRB. I've been on the air 2 weeks with Dialogue Conspiracy, 2 years with Dialogue Conspiracy. Since June, 2 years ago, 1971. And last year, I spoke to a lot of the different high schools at Carmel High, Monterey High, Pacific Grove, and the classes combined at Monterey last year, and we had one last session before school was out, and the climate, the elections were going to take place in the fall, the nominations would take place in the summer, and I spoke to the class about the electoral process, what had preceded the years before, and what the summer would be like. And in the Monterey High School paper, they had an article with a big writing across the top, U.S. government overthrown, Agnew becomes the dictator. And the quotations they had in there from the speech we had was that the electoral process is manipulated by powerful people in Washington and by the business world. I'm looking at the writer at Carmel at Monterey High had written this up, that Mae Bressel said that every election is decided by powerful men in the business world, by the military, the FBI, and the CIA. It said the United States government was overthrown in 63 and that this would be a very bad year because it looked like a military takeover, and the Nixon and Agnew would win in any way necessary. They would manipulate the election. And I had told the children, the students, you have to get control of your life and your own destiny, and went into past assassinations that these people in White House had done. The article said, Ms. Bressel alleged that the reason Governor Walz was shot is that he posed a threat to President Nixon's winning the crucial Southern electoral votes in the November election. And she predicted a fascist country which would be reminiscent, many citizens and politicians will be purged. It would be reminiscent of the days of Hitler. Now, that was the Monterey High newspaper in June 13th, 1972. And it was just 4 days after that newspaper came out that the arrest at the Watergate took place. And I don't know how many of the students that heard this, there were combined classes, maybe 100, 150 students there in the summer that followed and the fall. I don't know how many of them related it to the things I had tried to explain to them, but I was trying to explain about that hidden government at that time, and 4 days later, that government started to be revealed. And Tom Wicker in the New York Times this week has an article answering the people who say, let's get the hearings over with. Mr. Gurney on the Senate committee says, let's get it over with. A lot of pro-Nixon people are saying, we're tired of the hearings. Let's bring on President Nixon and find out if he had knowledge of the bugging or not. And if he didn't, let's get on with the matters of government. Tom Wicker said in the New York Times, this is no time to get it over with. And 1 year from the date of that discussion I had with those students at Monterey High, this is what Tom Wicker had to say in the New York Times. He said the investigations are important for the United States government, that Mr. Nixon's former attorney, John Dean, had papers, documents that belonged to Richard Nixon that exposed a Gestapo mentality, that the president's own description of internal security program that he authorized in 1970 makes it clear that it was planned as a secret police apparatus. They perverted the Constitution and other lawful security agencies. This was a wicked scheme, he said, that was thwarted by J. Edgar Hoover. Oh, yes, in the article with the kids, I mentioned the fact of J. Edgar Hoover being murdered by the same people. I had said that the CIA had killed John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, George attempted to kill George Wallace, and killed J. Edgar Hoover. But Tom Wicker mentions that J. Edgar Hoover did not want to cooperate with this secret espionage scheme, that he was against it. And he said, the one point is very clear. The men knew that the plan they were doing was indefensible, and everybody else involved was willing to go along with it. J. Edgar Hoover didn't want to go along with this secret police force that was going to sabotage the elections later. But everyone else was willing to go along with it. There have been allegations, moreover, that some of the practices Mr. Nixon wanted to carry out, like illegal surveillance, wiretapping, breaking and entering, are regularly engaged by other administrations, and it goes back to World War II. Not only the conceited Nixon scheme must be traced and exposed, but these charges, too, going back as far as World War II, for if it is confirmed, it means abuse of a police power and the subversion of the Constitution has far deeper roots than any shortcomings among Mr. Nixon's friends. And it's time for us to go into these matters and there's nothing to get over with. In other words, the New York Times was saying, you have this secret police force. It seems to have been a policy to subvert the United States government since World War II. And this is exactly what I was trying to explain to those students a year earlier. A lot of the news today, as I speak to you, was about the escalation of the war. If you read the front page of the newspapers this morning, there was articles that the war will continue. The San Jose Mercury, the San Francisco Chronicle, the U.S. war orders are soaring, long U.S. war roll seen. That didn't surprise me at all, that as of this June in 1973, the war is escalating, the war contracts are escalating behind our back, identical to the way Hitler took one country and then another country and another country in Europe. The election in 1972 presented a problem for Richard Nixon. He wanted to be a popular man, and he wanted to conduct his war at the same time. And now I'm going to swing into the motive of the Watergate so that nobody forgets it and remembers it very clearly what the Watergate was about. The election was coming up, and Richard Nixon wanted to be a popular man, popular enough to win the majority of the votes at home. And the people at home didn't like the war, and the youth were protesting it, exposing the mining of the harbors, the bombing of Cambodia. They didn't like it. And with the elections coming, he decided to make a trip to Russia and a trip to China, which would give the image of a man of peace. Nothing is coming out of those trips. I read just this week about the relationships with Russia being very bad. One of the things that came out of it was that the people that gave Richard Nixon money to become president got huge contracts. The oil company, Standard Oil, Esso, the wheat deal, the soybean deal, the Boeing aircraft to China, the people that put Richard Nixon in power will make money on contracts. Outside of that, nothing great has happened about his two trips to Russia, except they're muchly televised. He wanted the appearance of approval of war policies, which he intends to keep up. So he sent himself telegrams. He praised himself. He has a committee called the November Group in New York that puts ads in the newspaper, and they publish what a great man he is, and they make up names of people approving of the policy. George McGovern has been against the war since he was first in the Congress, in the Senate. He's always been against the war. It wasn't a political scheme, but he was selected as the man least likely to get the votes on a lot of other reasons. So every other potential candidate was eliminated, and the Republicans selected McGovern to be the candidate because he would be the easiest to beat. Ted Kennedy, if he decided to run with George McGovern, could have beat Richard Nixon. And what the Watergate was about was to overthrow the election in the event the Democrats had a chance to win the election. Now, the Republicans had been into a lot of work up to that time. Ted Kennedy was going to win. If he won the nomination, he looked like the biggest contender as far back as 1970. So at the Watergate hearings this week, it turned out that Mr. Lasowitz was receiving money. They began to reveal the money going out to other campaigns, and it seeped out that Mr. Lasowitz, the man from New York that was involved in threatening James McCord, or McCord took it as a threat about pleading guilty and shutting up. The man paid $22,000 a year plus expenses by Herbert Kalmbach from a spy fund. Lasowitz's assignment in 69 was to take care of Ted Kennedy, his electoral position, and he was actually up at Chappaquiddick. This is 69, that we have Mr. Lasowitz, the spy from New York, up at Chappaquiddick in 1969. The accident at Chappaquiddick that eliminated Ted Kennedy came just shortly after that visit. We don't know how many visits he's been there, but that in time I hope will come out. Mr. Muskie, Senator Muskie, was knocked out in Wisconsin. That came out in the news this week. Mr. Lasowitz was up there paying Segretti, Donald Segretti, agent provocateurs, pouring money into Wisconsin. All of the men in the way of Richard Nixon in 72 would be eliminated, and George Wallace was eliminated by a shootout in Maryland where he almost died, and he was left immobilized at the time of the election. It came out in the hearings this week, and we'll go into a little bit more this last week, that money was poured from the committee to reelect the president into the Wallace campaign, and they were sitting, John Mitchell was the attorney general, they were sitting in the Justice Department figuring out what to do with George Wallace. So Ted Kennedy, George Wallace, Senator Muskie were a thorn in the electoral process of Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew, and they were very nicely gotten rid of with thousands of dollars poured in to manipulate that they could not be elected. This, again, is what I was trying to tell these students that year, just a few months before these people were arrested. Now, the president is not going to sit back and be silent long. He's going to take an offensive and come up with statistics on why he had his secret espionage team, the team that knocked out Ted or Muskie or Wallace. He has to justify their existence. So he's coming out with statistics and figures like U.S. News had this week on radicals and hippies and what a danger they were. The biggest danger to them is that they called attention to the war policies, and they had to be bugged, they had to be framed, locked up with lengthy trials, and the rounding up of radicals in the event that Ted Kennedy took the nomination would eliminate any opposition to this administration while they went about escalating their war. Because the announcement was, we will get the money, whether Congress gives it or not. We will go into Cambodia, whether you give it to us or not, which is a real dictator kind of threat. This is the way I take it. So you have a police state escalation where the president intends to keep that war in Asia going. And you have a situation at home bordering on economic chaos and civil war. Nothing in the newspapers that I see benefits for minorities, prisoners, the leaders being killed. You have economic chaos at home, turmoil at home. He would have the radicals rounded up. And there were three methods of control to silencing any opposition to the war as it escalated. One was the control of radicals or political prisoners once they got inside prison. The other was the use of mental hospitals to silence opposition, and the fourth is the death penalty to silence opposition in a police state. Well, I've talked at length on Dialogue Conspiracy about the death penalty, the determination of the political figures who are funded, the same people that fund Richard Nixon, that fund the governor of this state and the attorney general, wanting the death penalty back. And I've talked about the murder of Assemblyman Robert Crown just a few weeks ago up in Alameda, who had a deciding vote in the Senate Judiciary on the death penalty. So today, the subject comes in about mental control, because Jack Anderson has an article in his syndicated column this morning about brain surgery, or the Clockwork Orange kind of thing that's planned for California. These situations were created as a contingency to the war escalation. They were planned before the election was over, and the operation, the operatives are ready to go. The war police state isn't here. And that's why I talk about these things at great length, to try and stop these institutions before they get too far. And one of them that came out in January I've talked about is that institute to study the causes of violence that would be centered at UCLA, at the Psychiatric Institute down on the campus, the medical school there. I went to the hearings in Sacramento. I've talked about them. Well, Jack Anderson has an article today that a psychiatrist from the Bay Area who's very much against psychosurgery, his name is Dr. Bragan, and Dr. Bragan has been speaking against altering brains because there is no record of what happens to these people. He's very much against the changing the minds of prisoners or minorities or anybody, and he's been very outspoken about that. So this Dr. Bragan has received a death threat from, in quotes, now this is the funny thing about it, but it isn't funny. He's receiving death threats from what he says are a group of prisoners at San Quentin. 60 prisoners from San Quentin have issued a word that the first man who's paroled will kill Dr. Bragan, because they want their minds altered. Dig this. They want their minds altered, 60 of them at San Quentin, and they're going to get Bragan if he doesn't approve of the mind-altering plan. Now, who are these 60 prisoners that want the mind-altering Clockwork Orange thing to go through in California? See, the cells are all set at Vacaville. The prison cells are set. They were going to do it 2 years ago. There was public opposition against it. They use anesthesia and prolaxin and these drugs that drive men crazy and on the brink of death and make them like vegetables, and offer a lot of parole, no consent, no foreknowledge. It's called consent for the testing, but the stories that I have about it are terrible. It's not really a consent. So the problem is that we're getting national attention now to the fact that a man who opposes brain altering of political prisoners or prisoners, his life is threatened. And that's why I believe that Robert Crown, I have more reason than that to believe that Robert Crown, the opponent of the death penalty, was killed. But here's an overt threat to a man, and I think it would be very interesting for the Department of Corrections, for Mr. Raymond Precunier, the warden at San Quentin, to produce publicly, put up or shut up, produce the list of 60 men, their names, their prison numbers, their family numbers, of those 60 men that want their brains altered, or they'll kill somebody if they don't. Because if those 60 men really want it, they can go get it done tomorrow. Their families probably could sign permission to get it done tomorrow. But it doesn't have to be a law in California for those who don't want their brains altered. See, some would be forced. They've admitted that some wouldn't have the right to say, because being as they're in there, they aren't knowledgeable to begin with. Let those who want to voluntarily go in with their own private doctors to go to this particular Dr. Brown in Santa Monica, he's already done. Dr. Hunter Brown has already done psychosurgery on 300 behavioral operations, and we haven't seen those people. I'd like to see 50 of those people. There was a television show about people who had their brain altered just recently on KQED, and the two people that spoke up for it were absolute vegetables. It was the most pathetic sight I ever saw. And if that speaks up for brain surgery, we're in a terrible way. So Jack Anderson today is talking about California psychosurgery, And I think it's a very serious problem, because as we go into a fascist state, or as the administration would want us to, we have to look at what fascism is. If Senator Sam Ervin says to the press and to his committee that documents were found in the White House files were so frightening, he doesn't know that we should see them, and he refers to them as Gestapo plans, we should know what they are. But in general terms, to be specific, I bring out institutions like this, threats like this, murders to the people who oppose the fascist plans, because those are the ones that are getting ripped off. And they call them the John Dean files, because at the White House, they were loaded at his desk and left there. They're the Richard Nixon files. He gave the approval for the plans. He organized the Gestapo. John Dean just started to work for them a short while ago. Refer to them as the Richard Nixon files. To justify the Watergate plumbers, the men who have been doing the espionage work and altering these candidates and elections for us, the president cited statistics of Robert Mardian that have come out recently that are very interesting, because he was the head of the Internal Security Division. And the excuse for the White House plumbers was that there's so much violence and lawlessness before the president took office that he had to protect us for national security, and cited the examples this week where in 1968, the rioting following Martin Luther King's death, the death of Robert Kennedy, the anti-war demonstrations in 69, the Kent State murders in 1970, the terror bombings in 1970, the Black Panther movement, the urban guerrilla warfare in 1970, the May Day attempts in the Capitol in 71, the Republican convention in Miami, and the shooting of George Wallace in 1972. And isn't it very interesting that every single one of these things was done by that secret police squad? And if they opened up the evidence, they would find that the police had the authority to kill, or the guards killed in these cases, or the government was in on funding the operatives down through a chain of command. Wouldn't it be interesting to open up the evidence and find out why James Ray never had a trial, and why he said that Martin Luther King had to be killed in an election year? And wouldn't it be nice to open up the Robert Kennedy information on the guns, the ballistic, the autopsy? Theodore Chirac, who did the research on the Robert Kennedy murder, called me this week, and he wanted to come up to Carmel and visit me. And he's finished that movie. They finished that movie called The Second Gun, with the evidence on the other person who had the gun that shot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head. And he wants a fundraising to get extra copies of the films to show it around the country. They have a few films, and they don't have many. So I told him to give me 3 weeks till I finish the article I'm doing now. And then I would announce on my radio program, and I'd try to get the Village Theater, and we'd be one of the first cities in this country to see the movie, The Second Gun, and he would be here, and other research would be here. So we're aiming it for July, and we'll have the movie on the shooting of Robert Kennedy here in Carmel, California. I'm trying to get that together now. But the excuses for the White House plumbers just happen to be done by cases where the evidence is all locked up, and the research proves that these were political murders done by provocateurs. New evidence came in on Kent State this week, the National Guard killing. And so they create, see, the Army and the intelligence agencies create a situation where they get violence, and then the violence is the excuse for their existence. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Every excuse listed for the White House plumbers operating this year can be proven to, the violence can be proven to be caused by paid provocateurs coming from the Treasury Department, the Internal Revenue, on down, narcotics and firearms, or the other agencies like the White House paying Segretti, again, he was in the Treasury Department, ex-FBI, on down, the attorney, Herbert Kalmbach, siphoning funds now to a liaison to the American Nazi Party. We'll jump to that right now, because I want to go slow, but I want to go fast at the same time. The excuse for the White House plumbers, and you read about them in the news, is that violence was everywhere, and that they had to have their own secret police force to keep track of the violence and the leaks coming out of the White House story. That's another big lie, like the Reichstag fire. The excuse for having Henry Kissinger's aides wiretapped in the White House tapped was that new leaks were coming out on the SALT talks that were to take place in Helsinki in July of 1971. The New York Times ran leaks. It's very interesting that the very person, Mr. Beecher, who ran those leaks, got a promotion now, and he's now Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs in the Defense Department. They allowed leaks to take place on the talks of the National Security Council. And because those leaks take place, they can say, we need a secret espionage team to find out what's happening. And then that espionage team sabotages the elections and all the candidates that oppose Richard Nixon. The conspiracy is complicated to people who do not think in terms of how these things are designed, but many, many of these conspiracies are planned and allowed to happen. Then when they happen, you can get a tighter law than you had before because you keep needing new laws of oppression, but there has to be an excuse to have them, so you recreate the excuse. The Pentagon Papers, it's come out, were known to the government that Ellsberg and Russo were copying. They watched them copy them. They let them do it. After they copied them, they gave them to Senator Fulbright and members of Congress and said, look what's happening in Vietnam. Our public officials are lying. The Congress did nothing with them. So they took them to the newspaper, New York Times, Washington Post, and then the government gets really excited and wants a new law that they can put someone in jail even without a trial for taking classified papers that are in the White House. And that makes every one of their espionage secrets tighter. They can't just make a law because we are supposed to be fighting for democracy. We still look like a free country, a two-party system. Our image is sold that way. So you can't make edicts come down like Hitler did in Germany. People would see the parallels too fast. So we create the situation, which was what Hitler had to do too. In order to round up the radicals, he creates the famous Reichstag fire and burns down his own building. He creates a system to justify the plans that were made preceding it, and then he can use the guise of protecting our peace agreement, the SALT talks, our international conferences, our secret classified papers. We create the situation with foreknowledge all along that it's going to take place. Now, the hearings last week let out a few little goodies. Sally Harmony was one of the witnesses, a secretary for G. Gordon Liddy, a real CIA secretary. She doesn't know what she's typing. She doesn't hear if the phone rings. If she answers it, she doesn't ask who's speaking. She takes letterhead from the Democratic stationery and copies it, but she doesn't know what it's used for. She burns things, but she doesn't ask why they're burned. She'll hand envelopes of hundreds of thousands of dollars to somebody, but she doesn't know what's in them. She's a marvelous secretary. She does everything right. Nobody gets in trouble. If somebody comes in the office, she wasn't looking. And if she typed a telephone conversation, she didn't know where it came from. Thank you, Mrs. Harmony. You've been a wonderful witness. We really enjoyed having you. That's the way the story went. She brought let out a little point. She was telling about the coded stationery, Ruby 1, Ruby 2, a crystal, the code names for gemstone, the secret file. She didn't think it was funny that everything she copied had to be burned after a group of people were arrested. Gemstone isn't anything special. It's an everyday job. One of the names, she couldn't reveal what was on the tape recordings that she was typing, but she let out the name Robin Cranston. The committee didn't ask what that was about. It passed them over. They have a script. You come in the morning, if you watch their hearings, they've got a list of questions. It doesn't matter what the person says that they throw out in the field there, they've got a script. So they sit there and look at their next question on the paper, and they miss everything. All the clues are going on. They haven't got a free thought of their own. They've got their little speeches written. She mentions Robin Cranston. Robin Cranston is the son of Senator Cranston. He happens to be a fairly good man from California. I don't think he's much more sincere than Senator Tunney. He's okay. He isn't bad. Let's say he's fairly conscientious. And he isn't bad. He could be a potential politician coming up because he plays a good, clean, middle-of-the-road position and he's serious about his job there. I don't know how to describe it. I would never rate him really high, but much above the group of men that are back there in Washington now. But his son got arrested this last year on charges of putting acid in a call girl's drink or some girl, and I didn't save all the articles on it. They busted him. She was supposed to have gone berserk and very sick, and the son was brought in on using drugs, putting drugs in her drink, acid, and it's an embarrassment to a man who's a member of the United States Senate. And so the little bit of incident happens, but it would be interesting if Senator Cranston wants to run for re-election, and they say, oh, look what your son did. You know, what was he doing with this chick? Or wasn't your son arrested? Or do you think you should have this position when your son was involved in this suit? So it's very interesting that if he has political aspirations, that the particular espionage squad that's in the White House and the committee to re-elect the president are so busy making our country secure from radicals, the part of their secret gemstone file has to do with Robin Cranston, and the committee didn't ask what that's about. Also in the news this last week was that G. Gordon Liddy had hired call girls to do the same thing that happened to Cranston down in Miami at the time of convention, to blackmail the Democrats and maybe some Republicans to keep them in line, and the girls had their jobs, they were ready to go. It wasn't told whether they met with these particular people at the time the convention went on or not, and the blackmail would be used later. But here you have millions of dollars dispersed to these committees and put into $100 bills of cash that goes to people to blackmail public officials that are doing their business or to get their sons into lengthy trials that are embarrassment that cause a lot of money to defend yourself to prove your innocence. So the little bit Robin Cranston was thrown out, nobody cared about that too much. Then Hugh Sloan threw out a figure. He was before the committee. He was the money man who received all these hundreds of thousands of dollars. He didn't know where it came from either, really, and he was very busy. April the 5th and 6th, before the cutoff day, they didn't have to reveal where the money came from after that day. He got between 5 and 6 million in 2 days, and that came into the office. And he had his hands full with all these $100 bills just pouring in from everywhere, but he did throw out that $10,000 was from California. Well, I've been writing to public officials up in Sacramento, every member of the Senate, members of the Assembly, and telling them Watergate affair is not a problem in Washington, D.C., that Watergate West will appear within a year in California. Watergate West spilled out a little bit this week with Hugh Sloan throwing $10,000 out to California. What was it used for? This $10,000 went to a liaison down to Lynn Nofziger. Lynn Nofziger's name is familiar. He's worked in the campaign with Richard Nixon for many, many years. He's now working with Ed Reinecke, who would like to be governor when Ronald Reagan steps down. The California director of the committee to re-elect the president was Lynn Nofziger. And he told Jeb Magruder that he could use this money and they were to disqualify voters on the American Independent Party. And an envelope was sent with $10,000 to a friend, in quotes. They don't know who it was, but Hugh Sloan gave $10,000 that came to Lynn Nofziger to California that went to a friend. The friend is a typical CIA cutoff. The name of a particular friend that received $5,000 is pictures of cash checks. Joseph Tomasi, age 22, member of the Nazi Party in El Monte, California. He met with Mr. Walters, recipient of this money, and Mr. Parker, I'll go into them, November 71. And he used his stormtroopers, his Nazi stormtroopers. They got out of their Nazi uniforms and worked as registrar of voters, 20 of them, neatly dressed, to dissuade the American Independent Party from meeting, they wanted to dissuade people from registering that and go to the Nazi Party so that Richard Nixon would get less competition from the American Independent Party, and if they're not registered, they wouldn't get on the ballot. Robert Walker was registered as American Independent. He paid members of the Nazi Party to encourage them to help him take votes away from Wallace, or he's alleged to have done that. He told Mr. Nofziger he could travel around the states. Now, this is what he said. He denied it later, but it would be nice to check out that he could travel around the state and get county officials to purge the voting lists of the American Independent Party. I spoke last week about Venezuela and the voting machines and what could have happened up here. You have people working as registrar of voting, tampering to get Richard Nixon elected. This is what they were doing, and to purge the voting list of the American Independent Party members. Mr. Glenn Parker met, he is an American member of the American Nazi Party. He met with John Mitchell and Jeb Magruder at the Los Angeles Hilton Hotel in October of 1971. John Mitchell had a conversation with him. If they want to get the party off the ballot, they have to get Nixon elected. He's the biggest threat. George Wallace, that time, was the biggest threat left. He'd gotten rid of Muskie and Ted Kennedy. He didn't say that many words, but Wallace is the biggest contender now to Richard Nixon's getting the nomination. One of the people they met with was a Jack Lindsay. He has a food supply company in Los Angeles, and Lindsay is supposed to have provided the first payment of $10,000. This intermediary with the Nazi Party, the American Independent Party, and John Mitchell is a former aide to Governor Ronald Reagan. This group, there was a group that met in Washington. A conduit of funds was set up to persuade people not to vote for Wallace in South Carolina at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington in 1972 in July. John Mitchell met with Harry Dent. That was a lawyer to the president, Harry Dent, and two funny names, Tom Turnipseed and Peter Vedder. I think of Peter Rabbit and Turnipseed. It's Tom Turnipseed and Peter Vedder in July 72. Vedder's a wealthy businessman who supported Wallace all the time up to that point. And he wanted to be governor once of West Virginia. And Mr. Dent is alleged to have offered Turnipseed in South Carolina a lot of money, a good job, 5 to 6 times more money than you'll ever make if you stick with Wallace, sabotage the Wallace campaign. Segretti had surfaced earlier, provocateur, that I mentioned many times on these programs, Donald Segretti. He had hired people to go down to the southern area to sabotage the Wallace campaign. Sloan sent $10,000 to California to sabotage the Wallace campaign. There's $25,000 not accounted for that went from the committee to reelect the president from Restand Safe, the same funds through the account of Congressman Hill, the man who's now dead, that was found dead out by his barn a few weeks ago. And Maryland is the state where George Wallace was shot, and there are a lot of people that could be paid off in Maryland, and $25,000 unaccounted for that Congressman Hill said he didn't even know about, and that he wasn't responsible for. He implied something hideous is coming up, and he had nothing to do with it, but it was channeled through his campaign. That's missing. So I wonder if that $25,000 went to the Wallace. If it didn't go to Hill, and the committee to reelect the president was throwing away their $100 bills, how much went to Maryland that went through Congressman Hill's account? Well, it's interesting that John Mitchell sits with the American Nazi Party. I'm sure he does favors for them. They do favors for him and Jeb Magruder, and that's the way you keep the election going in the United States of America. There was an interesting man brought down. I've mentioned on my program, he's brought down the grand jury, Elmer Davis, in Los Angeles this week. The grand jury investigating the robbery of the Ellsberg doctor's files. Elmer Davis was the man who was in Folsom Prison at the time that Beverly Hills Police Department said that he broke into the psychiatrist's office and took the Ellsberg files out of there. The man was at Folsom Prison. He was brought down as a witness. And the question comes up, why do the police want him to say he did it? Who forced him to sign the petition? I brought this up on several other shows. It's terribly important because in the expose of the files in the dean office and in the description of the Gestapo, they talk about the use of the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Secret Service, the FBI, Security Exchange Commission, all working in cahoots, but there hasn't been any mention of the local police department in each state where these conspiracies take place tied to the major espionage squad that operates in the White House. They've linked them as operating as a possible kind of operation since World War II. These plumbers have been linked as far back as 66 and then in 70. And But and back together in 72. A lot of the same operatives working together, and some new faces always added in. These new young faces, the cutoff of the big boys. But the police department hasn't been mentioned, so I thought in the remaining 5 minutes, I would show you how the local police department worked in Dallas, because these same operatives were working in Dallas when John Kennedy was killed. The day that John Kennedy was in Dallas, people thought there might be some tension because he was not popular in the South, and there were death threats, and Stevenson had been down there before, Adlai Stevenson, and Pickett's had spit on him and caused an altercation. So you would think that the most important police in Dallas would be working the day that John Kennedy went through to give him maximum protection. Most important means that men given the job of rounding up all the evidence after he was murdered must have a big responsibility. He was the President of the United States. But would you believe that every police officer that rounded up the evidence on John Kennedy's assassination the day he was killed did not work the day he was killed, that they were off? I went through the Warren Commission hearings, and it might be of interest for you to know, or if you're a Monterey library, you can look some of this up at MPC College. The police reports came through, and I got this through a different police testimony. I put it together myself. It went something like this. These were from volume 24. One was page 285. The Warren Commission asked a particular sheriff from the homicide division, Captain Fritz's homicide, Mr. Boyd, where were you the day of the particular of the shooting of John Kennedy? And he says it was his day off. A lot of people were off, and he was off, and he wasn't on assignment. Mr. Adamick, who was important in rounding up all the evidence at Ruth Payne's garage, the incriminating evidence, would say that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy. The Warren Commission asked Adamick, where were you the day Kennedy was killed? And he said, I was off duty. I was home when I heard that Kennedy was shot. I went to work at 2 o'clock for Captain Fritz. They asked Officer Anderton, where were you the day that Kennedy was killed? Because he went to work at Oswald's rooming house and picked up information. He said, at 2 o'clock at noon, I was home watching TV, and I saw a special news bulletin that the president was shot, and I went to work. They asked Officer Beck, where were you the day that Kennedy was shot? Because he was to take care, be in the elevator with Oswald and take care of information and isolate Oswald from the news media down the jail later. He said, well, on November the 22nd, it was my regular day off, and I heard on the news the president was shot, so I came in at 3:30. Officer Brown, where were you the day that Kennedy was shot? Because he was to pick up evidence, shells, and information. He said, last Friday, I went to work, but the other men were off, so I was working alone, and I heard that he was killed. Then he went on to his other assignment to pick up evidence. Mr. Doherty, an officer who later was to go and find the shells on the grassy knoll, or in the book depository, right, the 6.5 rifle shells, and take them to the crime lab. Captain Fritz gave him the shells and take to the crime lab. He had that responsibility. Where were you, Officer Doherty? He said, Friday on November 22nd, I was on a day off. I was called by Captain Wells at 1:30 to go back to work. The president was killed. So Captain Fritz gave me these shells, and I took them to the crime lab. Officer Graves, was interviewing Helen Markham, the only woman who said that Oswald shot Officer Tippett, where all the evidence came out that he wasn't shooting Officer Tippett, Oak Cliff section. They said to Officer Doherty, where were you the day that you interviewed after you saw Oswald and he took care of Mrs. Markham? He said, well, it was my day off, and I came in at 1:30, and they told me to take care of Helen Markham, and I interviewed her. Officer Hall, they asked him, he was in charge of interviewing people at the police station who would have contact with Oswald after he was arrested. Where was he? He said, on November the 22nd, I had a day off. I was home doing some work in my backyard. I was in the house, and I heard about 1 o'clock the president was killed, and I went on down. Marvin Jarson, another gentleman who was at a cafe where Oswald was supposed to have been and seen Mrs. Markham. Later, he went to the book depository and picked up incriminating evidence. The commission said, where were you? Marvin Johnson said, oh, at Friday, November 22nd, I was down at Dale's Cafe. He was off. It was his lunch hour. Then he came down to the book depository and took up evidence. It can go on some other time. I've got 12 other officers. Every one of them, the ones that went to Ruby's apartment, Oswald's rooming house, searched his room, went to the book depository where the rifle was, picked up the shells, picked up the rifle. None of them were working that day. They were all off. They conveniently came back in time to pick out the 12 pieces of evidence that were to say that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, and not one piece of evidence actually fit the ballistics, the crime, or the information that appeared later after the Warren Commission was written. So that's how the local police department works in cahoots with the Central Intelligence Agency or the operatives to keep the story as the planners in Washington wanted to come down. Okay, our time is up. Watch the Watergate hearings next week. Take notes. Send a wire to Washington. See you next week.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist Mae Brussel.